Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
I was always a dreamer. I always saw a life beyond the life that I had as a child.
It was like a big flashing light. This is what you're supposed to do.
Everybody poo-pooed the idea. Network said it couldn't be done.
You're in that zone, and it's that out-of-body experience where it just, everything clicks.
Sometimes you have those dark moments. I was so depressed when I got fired.
I was so mad.
People don't need to be afraid to fail. And again, that's where you learn. You shouldn't be afraid of adversity. You know, that is the thing that makes you strong.
This is Jerry Levias.
This is Jody Markell.
This is Chi Young.
This is Dick Vitale, and you're listening to American Achievers.
Welcome to American Achievers, the podcast that celebrates ambition, commitment to excellence, risk-taking, and tenacity on the road to success. I'm Keith Dunovant. Some of my guests are world-famous. Some are rather obscure. Our weekly lineup includes entrepreneurs, athletes, military heroes, civic leaders, artists, and media figures. What they all have in common is a sense of undeniable purpose and an intriguing story that reflects the power of the American dream. The allegations made by Susie Scott Krabacher in this two-part interview are hers alone. In fairness, we point out that Hugh Hefner was never charged with or convicted of a crime in this matter. He died in 2017. The current owners of Playboy have distanced themselves from Hefner and voiced support in the media for the women who have alleged abuse. Here's part two of my interview with Susie Scott Krabacher.
I didn't expect to be homeless after marrying. I didn't expect to lose everything again. But the man I married was not who I thought he was. As a matter of fact, the name on my marriage certificate was not his real name. I married him under the name of Michael. His real name was Richard. So when the SWAT team and the FBI were here in Aspen, they set up a roadblock. We were coming into town from the airport, and all of a sudden they're surrounding our car and calling him Richard. I'm like, you got the wrong guy. This is Michael. They're like, no, Susie, that's not his name.
I just got to ask. I mean, trust issues. Why would you ever trust another man?
Hard, hard, hard to do. I'm telling you. People think from the outside that if a woman is beautiful, that you can have anybody you want. Well, be careful about who you want is the big thing, because, you know, I can't believe to this day that I was so completely naive. But, you know, with Hefner, why in the world did I walk down that hall and knock on his bedroom door? Why did I believe him when he said, we're your family, we're going to take care of you, anything you want to do, you're safe? Why did I believe that? I didn't know him from Adam, and I believed him. And then when my husband asked me to marry him, I believed everything he said, that he had businesses in Europe, and that's why he always disappeared to Europe and left me here in Aspen. I believed that the reason he had so many guns was because he simply collected guns. I didn't realize that he was in the gun trade. I just, total naivete. I can't explain it. But when you're someone that has faith, I think you have to give another try. You have to believe that there's someone out there that is good, because if God is good, he has to have made some good people. And my husband, my divorce attorney, who became my husband, turned out to be just exactly that. I hit the gold mine with my husband. He is the most honest man that I have ever met. He, you know, every couple has problems, but he's never lied to me. And we've been together 33 years. So I can truly say that there are men out there who you can trust. I lead a very interesting life, and it's a very hard life. I live in Aspen, but I chose to take a different route and live a life where I'm in constant danger.
So Joe helped you. He believed in your dream and in the promise basically that you made to God. So
he did.
1994, yep. You went to Haiti for the first time. Why did you go, and what did that experience mean to you?
Well, Joe was a struggling lawyer when I met him. We had very, very, very little to our name. And when he started finally getting clients, and I was working part-time here in Aspen and just really not doing well. I must say that at that time I wasn't a very good business person, and I had a furniture store I was trying to run and just wasn't making it. And he looked at me one day and said, "You just don't need to do this anymore. I finally have enough clients that you can do what you want to do." And I said, "You know what I want to do?" He said, "I know, I remember." He said, you want to help children?" I said, "Yes, I do." So we just really thought, at that time, Mongolia was all over the news, much like Ukraine is on the news now. Mongolia had a real issue with orphans that were living in the sewers of Mongolia because it was warm in sewers, and there were hundreds of thousands of these children, apparently. And I told Joe, "I think this is what I'm going to do." So I literally sold some of our furniture and bought a ticket to Mongolia. And then that Sunday, after I bought my ticket, I went to church and I asked the church to please pray for me to have a safe journey to Mongolia and to have wisdom about what I could be helpful doing. And someone from church came up after and said, "Please don't go to Mongolia, go to Haiti. I just got back from there. I went there. Susie, you can do so much with so little in Haiti, and it's closer." And he showed me over lunch some of the photographs that he had taken in the slums of Haiti. So I changed my ticket. Joe said, "You know, I would rather have you go somewhere closer." And he says that it doesn't cost nearly as much to help there as it would in Mongolia. So I agree that you should try Haiti. So I went to Haiti, and I really just thought I would sponsor a few children in orphanages. Maybe, you know, everybody wants to hold babies and feel important and take pictures of yourself with the poor. And I must admit, that was really all that I thought I would do. But I got there, and first I checked into a hotel and found they did not have taxis back then, but you could almost always find a driver that would take you where you needed to go. So I got in the car with a man and I said, "Please take me to the poorest area of Port-au-Prince." And I had a little fanny pack with a few dollars, a water bottle, and that's it. So he took me to a place called City Soleil. I got out of the car and I started walking along a canal. I soon realized it was a sewage canal. And all these little children were naked and they were following me. And I turn around to ask the guy if he could find me a translator. And he was gone. And it was about 5 o'clock in the evening. And I was so far out of the area of downtown Port-au-Prince, I had no idea where I was. So I walked around and tried to just observe and be quiet and not be conspicuous. However, I'm a blonde with hair down to my waist and I'm in high heels and a dress. So I was very conspicuous. So at the end of a couple of hours, I had a little boy who had been translating for the UN soldiers following me and helping me a little bit. And I asked him, I said, you know, is there any place that I could sleep tonight until I can tomorrow walk to the main road? And he took me to his house where there were 17 other people. And I slept there that night. I woke up, I had a bite on my cheek, which I think was a bite from a rat. He walked me to the main road the next morning. I went back to the hotel and I decided, you know, this is where I'm going to work. I'm going to work in this slum. I'm going to start a feeding program because every child I saw had swollen bellies, infections, you know, just crusty noses, crying and starving. And for the first month, it cost less than $1,000 to feed 100 people a day down there. And when I came home, I sold everything I had in the antique store and told Joe, you know, this I'm gonna start working in City Soleil. And today we have, let's see, three schools, a medical clinic, three orphanages, one for disabled children, one for boys, one for girls, a church, a physical therapy center, because 63 of our 119 children are disabled children. And what we've done is I realized about 2 years into doing this work, it's now been 28 years, that not many orphanages in Haiti will take disabled or terminally ill children. So that became what we were all about, taking the children that no other orphanage would take. And we started hiring doctors, therapists, speech therapists, orthopedic therapists. And a lot of these kids, you know, within a year can walk, can talk. It's just that a whole lot of them were born so malnourished and with birth defects that happened during the process of birth that can be fixed.
And of course, you're talking about this is a massive infrastructure kind of effort.
It's huge.
It's huge. So take me through the building part. How in the world did you start that?
You know, I would never in my wildest dreams believe that I would have anything other than that little teeny tiny feeding canteen. It started with that little 100 person a day feeding campaign. And then I realized none of these kids were going to school. So I came back to Aspen and, you know, keep in mind, I have a 10th grade education. So I needed to surround myself with smart people. And thank the Lord, a lot of people cared about the stories I was telling them of children who were living in these conditions. I cannot describe what it's like to live in City Soleil. First of all, it is 100% gang warlord infested. The only reason I survived there is because the children of these warlords are fed and educated in my schools. That's the only reason that haven't been kidnapped or, you know, worse, shot. And I do give medical treatment to the wounded gang members in order to keep myself safe. We have a team of doctors and nurses. We have about 70,000 square feet of infrastructure on an 18 acre property. And then we're a little bit scattered. We have a very large school of about 750 children in Port-au-Prince proper. Then in City Soleil, we have a school of 300 and a feeding program in City Soleil. And then in a place called Williamson, we take care of about 8 to 10,000 people a month in our mobile clinics, our static clinics, our community center. We have a sewing school. We have a physical therapy center and a church, a massive farm. At any one time, we have usually about 1,000 chickens, 100 goats, some cows, some bulls. We grow, we have honeybees. We make our own honey. We have huge greenhouses where we grow our own food, and we sell a little bit of it for sustainability. We have a soccer program that it's more of a youth club, where the soccer program is just getting started, where we're going to have a soccer training camp, because a lot of the youth are very tempted to join the gangs. It's a lucrative employment to join a gang. They sell drugs, they kidnap. I've had 62 of my own children kidnapped in the last 28 years.
So 62. 62 of your own kids.
Yes. Yeah, it's every day. I mean, every day it's something down there. The thing now is the kidnapping of foreigners is really, I think there were 200 since January, and day before yesterday there was the gangs in our area are usually fairly docile, but a couple of days ago there were two gangs fighting each other, and by the grace of God the police came and started shooting, and one gang fled. The other gang started hiding in people's houses, and one of the gang members tried to hide in our orphanage. We have a very high wall and we have a security tower. We're very well armed, but somehow this guy, even though we have broken glass all over the tops of our walls, this guy crawled over, got into the orphanage, and was chased back over the wall by our dogs and our security. But you know, this kind of thing happens a lot. It's pretty apocalyptic right now. I every day I get video of, you know, people being beheaded and killed, and it's really tragic what's going on right now in Haiti.
Are you kind of inured to the pain and the tragedy of all that stuff, or does it still affect you the same way it did in 1994?
No, it still affects me exactly the same. I think I understand how first responders deal with this kind of thing. I have been a first responder to both earthquakes in Haiti, and seen things that you never forget. You know, I've seen my own medical team sawing the legs off of people just to get them out of the rubble, and trying to comfort someone who has had no anesthesia and just lost their legs. You learn to do what you have to do at that moment. As I said, a lot of my children are terminally ill, and in the years that I've been in Haiti, my husband and I have buried over 400 children, and it doesn't ever stop hurting, but I keep telling myself, they're fine, they're in heaven, all children go to heaven, and I don't need to worry about them, I just need to get through my life without them and save another one.
You're listening to American Achievers. Stay tuned for
for more conversation. The problem there is so big, it's almost unimaginable to even get your arms around it. How do you deal with the fact that you can't save everybody?
We have not been able to save everybody, and that really angers me. But we've saved tens of thousands, and it makes a dent. And the ones that we have saved, we're not just saving them, we're educating them, and we're growing a generation of leaders, very strong, educated leaders, who once I'm gone, will carry on and keep going in their own country. And hopefully, certainly, we are raising the next presidents, congressmen, senators in that country, because our kids have the opportunity to go to university. They have the opportunity. I've taken many of my kids to Washington to meet our senators, congressmen, presidents, ambassadors. My kids, all of them, take speech classes where they have to learn how to publicly speak by the time they're 14. So I want my kids to have a very loud voice. Their stories, oh my gosh, their stories are so much more compelling than mine. I have one child who I communicate with at least once a week. He was found in the sewage canal that I was talking to you about earlier, with a cement block tied to his legs with a rope, and was barely floating above the water or the sewage to survive. He was a toddler. We think when we found him, he was a little over 2 years old, and he was trying to keep himself above the sewage to breathe. And someone saw him and dove in and got him, untied the cement block and brought him to us. He had clubbed feet. His legs were very, very crooked. And in Haiti, that's a curse. It's considered a curse. If you have that curse, then you are a demon in Haiti. So someone had tried to kill him, thinking he was a curse. Well, right now he is all over television in Wales. He's the number one rugby player in Wales. We adopted him to a family when he, very soon after we rescued him and rehabilitated his legs and got him the operation that he needed. And he's now famous. And he does not even know that that's how we found him. I'll never tell him how we found him. I don't want him to know that.
Because you don't want him to feel like he was abandoned by his family.
I don't want him to think that he was thrown into human feces to die.
Obviously, it's taken a lot of money. You've had to raise a lot of money to make this happen. How did you do that?
Well, I've found that you don't need to be highly educated to tell the story of others. And I have so many children with stories just exactly like the one that I told you. I've had children come in who have had their head sliced open by machetes because they've been part of voodoo rituals. I have children who have come to me with every single disease known to man. And we save most of them. Most of them make it if we get them in time. And who doesn't want to save a life? Who doesn't? And you can, I'm not saying it's easy, but it's doable. Anybody can do it. Anybody can advocate for another human being. It doesn't cost you anything to do that. And most of the time, if someone will listen, it's expensive to give your emotions to a person. It's very expensive. That costs me a great deal. Every time I find a child, that is the most expensive thing that I can give is to start loving them. So that's on me to love them, but it's on me to tell somebody about them who has the financial blessing that I may not have to help all these kids. I mean, there are so many of them that I could never be that wealthy, but I can certainly tell other people, look, you have the opportunity with your wealth to save a life today. Because if you do that, I will find another child that is abandoned. And I get phone calls and texts every week of another child that's been abandoned because maybe it has a cleft palate, maybe it has club feet, maybe it has AIDS. You know, we have that as well. And it's not expensive in Haiti to raise these children. It costs me, if I educate, if I give physical therapy, all the medical needs, sometimes surgeries, 24-hour care, because you can't take a child and expect them to raise themselves. You have to hire people to stay with them like a real mother would do. I can't stay with them all the time, although I'm there a lot. I have to hire mothers to stay with them. It costs about $500 a month to raise a child from an infant to an 18-year-old, like you would raise your own child here. And here, it probably costs about $100,000 to raise an American child from infancy to 18-year-old. And our kids, we take them on outings, we take them to the beach, we take them, like I said, to meet senators, congressmen, business people. They're not just living in an orphanage, they're living a life of a child that feels adored, loved, cherished, and like they can be something. My kids are, you know, for Haiti, they're kind of bourgeois orphans. We have solar energy. We don't have we're very off the grid. Most of Haiti's off the grid, but we do have solar energy, which means we have lights. We have running water, which is unheard of in Haiti if you live outside of Port-au-Prince. So we're raising them as if they're our own children. They go to church every morning. They have prayer time. We have birthday parties for every single kid. So we don't like to call them orphans because they're our kids. They bear my last name, but we certainly can't do it alone. No one can raise 119 children alone.
What do they think about this nice American woman, this pretty American woman who has adopted them? I mean, how do they process that?
Well, some of them are making me pull my hair out right now because all at once we have 27 teenagers, and teenagers are something I have never experienced before. So this is a new thing for me. We're having to learn how to deal with, our kids are hitting puberty. They have so many, there's a lot of hormones going around down there. So we're doing things like yoga classes at the orphanage. We're letting the kids take part in, inviting the community to have, social time where they can invite the entire community to come. And we have a band in our orphanage. We have musical instruments and the kids have formed a band and they dance. And I think that in the beginning, I scare the little ones to death because I'm usually the first white person they've ever seen. So, it takes a while to get them to let me hold them and love on them. And most of them have been hurt by someone, and most of them are traumatized because many, like the one that we just bought, was abandoned in last July, and we only found him in December. So he was abandoned by himself for months, and a kind person at the hospital where he was abandoned fed him occasionally, and he survived. But right now, that little boy is in therapy. He's 18 months old, but he's going to be in therapy. We have a child psychologist at the orphanage to help these children get through the shock of abandonment and not ever seeing their mother or father again. So normally I'm not a savior or anyone they love or care for. In the beginning, it takes a long time for them to start loving me back.
And what do you get out of putting your heart out there? What does it give you?
Well, I don't have biological children, and I never thought I would be a good mother, but it turns out I'm really a good mother. And I love when children go through seasons. So it's always the season of getting them to trust you. Then they trust you, and then they become a little child, and then they start having fun, and then they start laughing and smiling. And then those years, you know, the years from 3 to 11 are just wonderful, wonderful fun. And then they turn teenagers, and then it's really hard. We have to have so many conversations about, why was I given up? I had one little boy, his name's Johanno. He asked our child psychologist the other day, why did my parents give me away? I'm so beautiful. I'm like, well, that's the sweetest and saddest question I've ever heard. He knows he's beautiful, which means we're successful in making him feel beautiful. But now he's come to realize that his parents left him. So once they hit the age where they start asking those very, very hard questions, they need a lot of help and a lot of love and a lot of attention. They need one-on-one attention, not just being in an orphanage, you know, with a bunch of other kids. They have to be their own little person, and making sure that they feel like they're their own little person when you're growing up with such a massive family. And, you know, we also have children from the community coming every day. We have about 300 kids coming in from the community every day. And then we have lots and lots of social events for children in the community, feeding programs, medical care programs. So it could be very easily for their identity to be lost in the masses of people that we help. So it costs about $150 a month in Haiti to hire a nanny, a 24/7 nanny. And that's actually a very good salary in Haiti. Their dollar goes much further than ours. So for every four children that I have, those four children have their own house mother or nanny, if you will. So I get to know what is happening in every one of their lives at any time I want to know. Okay, so what is Naika doing today? I know who to ask. What is Johanno doing today? What is T. David doing today? Oh, you're telling me that Jessica broke her arm today. What happened? You know, so we have the whole gamut. We have the medical team lives on campus. We have the nurses on campus. We have the physical therapists on campus. We have the psychologists, the speech therapy, and the school on campus. So it's wonderful chaos. And I just adore chaos.
In the beginning, how important was your celebrity in raising the money?
Well, I do think that it helped get me in the door many, many, many times. But I've noticed now that it's several decades that since I've been in that celebrity world, but now I'm known as the Haiti lady. And I think that, yes, in the beginning, definitely got me in the door. No denying that. But now, if I were to call, let's say, the owner of a football team, or the CEO of Bristol-Myers Squibb, I could get them to speak to me simply by telling them the numbers of people that they can help, and never even mention Playboy. It's possible that they can Google it, but it usually doesn't come up in meetings anymore. And I am so completely into my kids, because if you don't give me the money I'm asking for, or at least help me find the money I'm asking for, then my kid's not going to get his heart surgery, or my kid's not going to get the neuro. A lot of my kids have something called hydrocephalic syndrome. And that's where they have water on the brain. And when they're born, if it's not fixed immediately, their head can grow up to 40 pounds. And it's an issue that will eventually kill them. But it costs so little, less than $1,000, to do the operation. And I have a lot of these kids. So on any one year, I may have to raise $25,000 to get those surgeries. And if you tell someone, look, maybe you don't have the money to help me, but I think you might be able to introduce me to somebody that does, this child will certainly not live till July if we don't do this. So, you know, please, please help me. And people love to say that they've done something that saved someone's life. Who doesn't love that?
And what have you learned about yourself through this experience, this journey?
I cannot believe that I've stuck with anything for 28 years. I was a bit scatterbrained, I think, when I was younger, not focused. I have laser focus. I am very surprised that I can bury children and go on. On my last trip to Haiti, two of the children died within one day of each other. And I couldn't believe it, because one was not expected at all. He had cerebral palsy, and he was 6 years old, and he was doing just fine. He was getting better, and he died of seizures. We could not get the seizures to stop, and we did everything, and we couldn't save him. So I was mourning that, and it was during a time that there had been another earthquake in Haiti, and the president of Haiti had just been assassinated. So I could not find a morgue that was open. And that was traumatizing to me and to everybody, because you want to preserve this child's body and integrity and bury him with, you know, with honor. And that just killed me. I spent no sleep trying to find a morgue just to take care of him, because I wanted to bury him properly. Well, while I'm doing that, one of our babies, who we knew was terminally ill, we knew that he had only a few months to live when we took him, he died. So all of a sudden, I've got two children that I can't bury properly. And, you know, we were marching against time because, you know, no refrigeration. And we managed to just to rent a coffin for each of them. And we had to bury them without a coffin. And I've never done that before. I've never buried my children without a coffin. But that was the first time for me. And I was very surprised that we got through that. We did it. And we managed to do something that seemed so completely unnatural and take another baby within 2 weeks. It's like every time you take a very sick child, you don't know if you're going to have to go through the burial process again. And I finally learned that I will do it no matter what. I'm going to take them. I can do this. And I have a really amazing team of 160 Haitian employees that they go through it every single day. You know, I go down every other month, but they go through it every single day. And if they can do it, then heck yeah, I can do it too.
And how can people out there listening, how can they help with the Haiti Project?
You know, I would really recommend that they go to HaitiChildren.org, our website, and look at all the things that we do. And remember that we cannot do this by ourselves. I'll never stop talking about these children, and I'm happy to talk to anyone. The number to call is on the website. You can ask for Susie. You will get me. If I'm not there at the moment, I'll call you back. We need financial help always. That is the biggest thing. We can't save children without people helping us do that. It is not expensive, but it's costly, both in your time, taking the time to actually research us and know that we are legitimate and we've been doing this for 28 years in Haiti, on the ground. Read my book, Angels of a Lower Flight. That tells you the story that, you know, more in depth than I've gotten to talk to you about today. It tells the kids' stories, but it also tells my story from growing up until right about now.
Well, you
and pray for us.
Yeah, and do you feel God's presence in your life now?
Totally, totally. I wish that I wish Jesus would come back today and just take all of us, so we never have to do this anymore. But as long as I'm here, this is my job, and this is what I'll do until I do leave the earth. And I want people to do it with me.
Well, you've spent so much of your life trying to save these kids. Do you feel safe now yourself?
No. No. On my last trip, I wore a disguise because they're kidnapping people. The gangs are, there are two main gangs, and the gangs are now kidnapping people right out of the airport. They're going into churches and kidnapping the ministers out of churches. They're going into hospitals, kidnapping the doctors so the doctors can treat the wounds of the gangs who have been, the gang members who have been shot. Right now, I think that the number is up to 5,000 people have tried to take boats to get to the South Florida because they are, the massacres that are happening in the slums, especially in the one that I work in. I have some of the most, I've never seen video of the type of deaths that these people are enduring. They're decapitating these people, they're dismembering these people. And it's, you walk into any one of these slums and you will see exactly what I'm talking about, because it's not like they have the will to bury the gang members, so they stay there. My kids walk by a cadaver on the way to school, on the way back to school, at least once a week.
Incredible. Looking back on your life, what is your message to young people who've suffered abuse?
Tell. Don't wait and find somebody, even if it's a stranger that seems kind. Make sure that it is someone that's kind, and tell them. Don't keep it in. I wish that I had had the words when I was a toddler to know how to describe what was happening to me. I didn't know, and I was scared because I was told that if I told, that I would be killed. And that's a scary thing for a kid. I would say run and tell.
Do you feel like you've transcended that now?
I'm not afraid of death at all. I thought when I first started having to lay my children to rest, I would spend a lot of time with the deceased, thinking that I would get anesthetized to the loss and the pain and the shock. That didn't work for me. So I just had to realize that they are okay. I do not need to be sad for them. I'm sad for me because I have to live in the world without them. But then every single birthday, I'm 1 year closer to them. And it goes fast. It goes very, very fast.
If you could go back to that adolescent girl in Alabama in the late 70s, to that girl who was just struggling, I think, to hold on, right?
Mm-hmm.
What would you tell her?
First of all, I would hug her. I would hug her so tight, and I would look in her eyes. And I would say, I love you. I love you more than anybody on earth ever will. If you can really love yourself, then, you know, usually people grow to love themselves because somebody raised them with love. I was not raised with love. So I didn't get to love myself, and I didn't think much of myself. But now I do love myself because I have permission. It says, love your neighbor as yourself. So that means I have permission to love myself. And I beat myself up still. You know, I always will. Every time I give a speech in front of 100 people, I'm a nervous wreck. I try every day to build my own confidence. But what I know that I know is that I know how to raise kids, and I know how to raise hurt children to be better, well, healthy, and happy. I've done that. I've done it thousands of times, so I know that I can do that.
Thanks to Lane McGivney and all the good folks at Boutwell Studios for all the TLC required to bring this podcast to life, and audio engineers Joe Beeman and Jonathan W. Hickman. Remember, everyone has a special talent. You just need to identify it, cultivate it, and be willing to pay the price. You, too, can become an American Achiever.